What about the tax benefit which you get from employing a new young person? You get half his yearly salary as a tax deduction. Is that a contribution to getting jobs and the economy and using the private economy? Well, I'm its author. So, you know, let's look at the record. I'd love to look at the record. Now let's go a little deeper in the record on the balanced budget. The budget is unbalanced today because we have hit a snag. We all voted for it. I did. Voted for a balanced budget because the other method seemed not to be getting anywhere. That is the method of really stimulating the American business community. So I voted for the balanced budget, and I voted for the cuts which the balanced budget implied. And I tried to spread the cut so they would not be too harmful, and submitted the budget myself as an amendment, though it failed. Got some 30-odd votes, but it failed, which increased defense by $3 billion over what the Budget Committee had reported to the Senate, but also spread a couple of billion, it doesn't take much, among these programs which deal with the young, the lame, the halt, the blind, etc. But the budget got away from us because we have to spend a lot more money for defense. It's got away from all of us. I mean, it's admitted now to the extent of $30 billion, and with a tax cut, it'll be more. But you got to make a tax cut useful. Now, let me give you another one. You now get a $200 deduction from interest earned or dividends in order to encourage savings and investment. I am one of the parties to that, with Senator Benson of Texas, with Percy of Illinois. You know, let's look at that record. For years and years and years, and now things are finally beginning to come through. But Mr. D'Amato prefers not to see it because it doesn't suit his political purpose.
I'd like to just say, let's look at the record. You weren't there 6 years ago, 5 years ago, to offer and to push through this kind of legislation that would make it possible for business to retool, for capital formation, for tax reform that does not discriminate against married people. It's an election year that you first come around, just like you come around once every 6 years. Why is it that it's just this year? And when I read that you chaired the fiscal task force and I read the report in July of 1979, I certainly knew, Senator, that you were going to run again, because it flew in the face of all of the votes repeatedly in terms of fiscal restraint, in terms of balancing the budget, in terms of giving corporate tax relief so they could retool, that get voted against repeatedly in the past 6 years.
May I help Mr. D'Amato a little? Were you equally disappointed with the report of 77? That was 2 years before.
I'm disappointed, Senator, in that I have not seen any legislative action on your part, and in terms of the votes and in terms of the records for voting for the big spending programs and against budget cuts, against the Kempforth bill, not just this year, last year, against fiscal prudence, against hiring more people. Senator, why is it that you wouldn't ask the Congress to go along with simply a 1% attrition cut in terms of the number of civilian employees? We weren't talking about firing them. They were saying, as people die, as they retire, don't just automatically go out and replace them. Yet you were one of the two votes that voted no. I think people have a right to know why.
I'll explain it exactly. I never vote for cuts. I have one aberration from that that I'm sorry for, which is simply across the board, and do not select what they cut and why. I don't know whether they're cutting bone and the nerve or whether they're cutting fat. And when I know they're cutting fat, I'm ready to do it, if that seems to me to be the right course for our country.
You know,
so I said, just a minute, I said, why didn't you go back 4 years? Why only two? If you were reading those reports, it would have been very illuminating to you to go back to 77, when I first became, I couldn't have done it before, as chairman of the task force, chairman of that task force, because it didn't suit you politically.
No, Senator.
You've got a view, just a minute, sir. You've got a view only of today. So you impute it to others. And I'd like to make it clear in this case.
Senator, the record is April 25th, 1979. Senator Javits, you were one of the two votes in an attempt to bring about a modest reduction, and I think this typifies your kind of voting in this area. It may be right. Maybe a majority of the people agree with you on these issues. I say that what we need is some fiscal restraint, and that even a modest attempt had some fiscal restraint, a 1% attrition rate. Senator, you know, they turn over in certain years 6% and 7% of the civilian workforce and the United States government. You mean to tell me that they can't come up with a 1% attrition factor? That would have cut the bone? That wouldn't have cut the bone of marrow. I want to tell you something. We've got too many bureaucrats down there. We need a couple more computers doing the work. We don't need a federal Department of Education who is more interested in all kinds of social experimentation than in terms of getting the aid to the handicapped into our school districts. That's the problem. We've got a government that is created to exist for itself, and it's forgotten that it's supposed to work for people.
Government cuts should be with a scalpel, not a cutlass.
I don't think a 1% cut.
Now, Mr. DeMaulo, I listened to you for a long time.
Yes.
Government cuts should be with a scalpel, not a cutlass. And if you're going to cut them with a cutlass, you're going to work against the interests of the people of this state. And I started to say when you interrupted me that your difficulty is you're a young man in such a big hurry to get yourself elected that I don't know what you'd stop at.
I would certainly have voted, and let me go on the record, having voted for a 1% attrition rate, which would have afforded the people a savings of $1 billion. I think that is just a minimal start, and that we now set up for the first time some areas, legitimate differences in terms of our perception as the government.
I have cast 10,000 votes. 10,000 votes in 24 years. I don't know what vote Mr. DeMaulo is talking about. How can I speak to it?
April 25th, 1979, Senate Resolution Number 52. Senator, your staff has recorded it. I've given it to you a dozen times, Senator, and you've heard it.
No, I'm very sorry. That's really, you know, pretty rough debating, but it's okay.
Okay, I'll put it on my
It might just be my notes, but I'd like to make a couple of gaps to show me.
Senator, I'm not sure if you said you were for a national welfare standard. Mr. DeMaulo, I don't know if you said what you cut specifically, other than the 1% attrition. I think it's Mr. DeMaulo's turn. What would you cut when you could save some money?
I would put a freeze on the hiring in the federal bureaucracy. I believe that a freeze of that type could save in the course of the next 2.5 years. And attendant with that, by the way, is when we talk about freezing, with the exception of those essential positions that a department head or secretary deems to be necessary and appropriate. We don't say that we're not going to replace everyone, but a very real and bona fide attempt to shrink the government bureaucracy.
Like New York City has done, for example.
Well, like the town of Hempstead has done, for example, like New York City has done in certain areas, and certainly we're talking about, we're not talking about the life and death services, we're not talking about police services, we're not talking about picking up the garbage or cleaning the streets, and I think if any place they should cut and reduce the workforce, it's right there in that federal bureaucracy, where they're more interested in their own special programs.
Would you cut any programs or any agencies or any major specific...
Let me say this to you, I would certainly not approve new program, which is going to come to pass, and I'd like to hear just another Humphrey Hawkins, hiring 900,000 new employees and putting them on government work jobs and government work programs because we're talking about billions of dollars more.
And what about existing?
The best, and this falls within the same line, food stamp program, fine program, but give people an incentive. Don't just say, have it for nothing. Let them put something up so they understand that's the value of this great country. Well, we challenge the individual initiative, not so that you just walk in and say, well, here are food stamps, and now we'll take them. This is part of the great system. So what we've done is we've gone far beyond in program after program after program.
Like a couple.
Well, I have indicated to you that I think, for example, the expansion of the federal food program works a disservice, was wrong. Humphrey Hawkins was wrong. Legal Services Corporation has gone far beyond what it should be doing. I think that we will find if we examine, and we should have a real intergovernmental task force. And by the way, A.B. just came down with a report and chairing this task force, and what did it say? It said Congress has let these programs get beyond it, not just the president. And they have created today a labyrinth of programs that they can no longer control. We had better go after that, not what I'm suggesting. Senator Javits has been one of the architects of creating this huge bureaucracy that no one can get their hands on. And that he is not in a position because his whole philosophy goes in a different direction to begin to try to curtail it. Curtail its growth and bring it back so that it can be productive.
Yeah, it might be a little bit out of order, but could I just get straight on welfare, Senator? Are you for a national standard?
I'm for a national standard.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's in my bill, my 79.
And New York would not be able to add to it?
No, I didn't say that. New York might or it might not.
But then that would be a national standard.
Well, it's a national standard from the federal government. That's what
we
complain
have now.
About now. No, we don't. What we have now is a national standard based on per capita income.
Yeah.
And per capita income cheats us because it omits what is called severance, that is when a state has oil or coal
and taxes it.
Right now, Texas and California are about to become so financially independent that they're going to give their people back all their taxes. That's the kind of competition,
by the way, we're facing.
But in other words, when you speak of federalization, you mean the federal government picks up the bill, but New York has the standard? In other words, a blank check?
No. The criteria in the standard would be composed not only of per capita income, but of property values and of severance income by the particular state.
And
that would materially adjust the formula.
And would it, as Mr. D'Amato apparently is willing to accept, a reduction in the New York level in order to get a federal standard?
It would probably. It would probably cause a reduction, and my bill calls for a reduction.
And you'd accept that?
As a matter of fact, and I would accept that. Now, whether the state or the city adds is up to the state or the city within their particular fiscal means. In other words, the state or the city wouldn't necessarily be barred from adding. That's up to the state legislators and the city legislators. I can't control that.
Well, we'll have the same kind of situation.
Now, wait a minute. You would not have the same kind of situation. They're legislators, too. They're entitled to do whatever they think they ought to do in the interests of their people.
It's not a U.S. preemption.
That it will be just so much. If the U.S. will contribute, according to my bill, about 60%, whereas it contributes today only 50%. And if New York's situation should worsen, heaven forbid, it would contribute more, up to 75%. And those are the generality of bills, Moynihan's bill and my bill and all. So that's the way that particular thing.
I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
No,
I speak on the matter of
okay. Well, let's get what the matter is.
Yes, ma'am.
You'd be good enough to tell me what the question is.
Yes, no, that's it.
Against quotas. I was started to be against quotas when there were quotas for medical schools
years and years and years ago.
And fought them bitterly. Where, however, you have a pattern of discrimination, that's what the law says, where you have a pattern of discrimination, and that has to be made up for somehow, then I believe with now the Supreme Court, which in the Fuller Love case has just held accordingly, that a
target may be set for minority hiring for as long as it may take, and generally it doesn't take all that long,
in order to try to make up, to some reasonable extent, for past misdeeds. I do not consider that to be a quota. I consider that to be a sanction for having violated the law and the Constitution for years before, and that is my argument.
What would you have done specifically about this particular program, which would have abolished civil service tests, for example, and any kind of educational qualifications?
Well, I think that that's, I don't know that you're right about that, Frank.
I don't think you're right about the fact that it abolished civil service tests.
As I read the story, they did take civil service examinations. Some did not do as well as those that were not.
This is the proposal. This is the proposal.
A proposal I don't agree with, because I believe, as a matter of equal opportunity, that those who have been disadvantaged should be brought up to the starting line by education and training, and then put on the same starting blocks as everybody else. And that's what I believe in as a policy
for the future, whenever you start.
The difficulty is there are many instances in which this has been denied. So there has been a buildup based upon discrimination, which is unlawful and against the Constitution. And it is in order to deal with that
that the Supreme Court
decided what it did in the case that I cite very recently.
I'm absolutely opposed to that agreement. That agreement sets exactly and precisely what I believe is abhorrent in the American a person even has the beginnings, the makings, the potential of being a bona fide police officer. And so I said no.
And I think it is that kind of situation that we find ourselves
where the Justice Department is attempting to bring in quotas, purely, simply.
Yes, I had the courage and the guts, and I was brash enough to say no. And I'm not going to knuckle under to the federal government withholding $19 million in
aid and all the kinds of threats that are attendant with it.
I think that's wrong.
And I think what we have taking place today is this huge runaway bureaucracy that says we're going to tell you locally what's going to be. No civil service exams of any kind. We're not saying that if you don't score on the top, that we're saying you don't even take an exam. And indeed, it even went to the essence in terms of promotions, that it said that in terms of promotions, we would abolish examinations. I don't believe that that's the jurisprudence system of the nation. I don't believe that it's the spirit of this nation. I'm opposed to it.
And that is why?
I block its implementation. And regardless of the outcome of this election, if I'm there, I will continue to oppose it. Because there are those who would characterize my opposition as merely temporal, merely something of convenience. Let the record speak. Win, lose, I'm opposed to it, and I will fight those kinds of so-called consent decrees. And I really don't believe that that speaks to the best interest of the minorities or the women who are attempting to say, let's give equal opportunity. That's not what equal opportunity is about.
The Democratic Senate candidates have made much of the allegation that New York has been shortchanged in federal aid. First of all, is that a valid charge? And secondly, if it is, what have you done about it, or what will you do about it?
Well, let me tell you, it certainly is true. The fact of the matter is that the state of New York provides approximately 35% of the nation's public transportation. The fact is that we get back roughly half, about 18%. It means that that formula, that funds in terms of mass transit systems is totally inequitable and should have been changed years before. Now I understand there's a Senate bill that was passed, Senator Moynihan, Mr. Javits voted for it, and would do something that's in the Senate. We don't know if it's going to get through the House of Representatives, but why now? Why this year? Why not 6 years ago, 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago? What I'm saying is what we're beginning to see when I say a born-again fiscal conservative, or more than that, maybe more appropriate, is someone who for the first time is beginning to pay attention to the nitty-gritty here in this city and here in this state. I think we need a senator who's here more than once every 6 years, but who's got a real and a constant presence, meeting with local officials. And when we have a welfare system that does what it does and has encouraged the migration of the nation's poor, a system, by the way, that basically has not been altered since 1946, the funding apparatus that rewards New York to the extent that we get 50% reimbursement. Some of the fabulously wealthy states get 72% reimbursement. Why is it that not just this year when we have an election, but 6 years ago, 10 years ago, when we saw what was taking place, that we didn't have a senator who used the so-called clout that he has in terms of 24 years and the great respect that his colleagues have in terms of fighting for and calling that to the attention of the public and his colleagues and being persistent? Let me tell you again, Dan Moynihan has had the courage and the guts to stand up and to do that. What I'm saying is that what we need is a senator who is committed to legitimate changes in need because the working people and the taxpayers of this state cannot continue. And local governments, my county, which will have to pay $250 million next year for welfare and Medicaid, and all of the upstate counties and the city of New York that pays $1.3 billion, can't make it. We continue those systems. And it's not good enough to have rhetoric to say, well, this year we're fighting for a change and we have a chance. The fact of the matter is, I think that after 24 years, there's been more than ample opportunity to address oneself to that problem and long before this year.
I have addressed myself to that problem for 24 years and have addressed myself to that problem for 12 years before then in the House of Representatives. It was always clear from the very beginning. And the facts are that in the last 4 years, things have begun to give. The fact is that New York State got back 85 cents out of every dollar sent to Washington 4 years ago. Today it gets back well in excess of 90 cents. I think the figure is 96. That's very considerable improvement. Not in 1 year, but in 4 years. And other formulas have been changed. For example, for the first time, I succeeded in making some change in the Hill-Burton formula, which is a formula relating to the construction of new hospitals and new hospital beds. and other formulas with relation to education have been changed, like the elementary and secondary education formula, which relates to the education of poor children. The way I did that was by having two special programs. This is some years ago, which I sponsored. One was concentration grants, where there is a concentration of poor. An additional factor is figured in to give New York more money and other comparable states. And the second is for public housing. There's a program called the Impact Aid Program. And I got the public housing included under Impact Aid. And therefore, New York, for the first time, gets $20 or $30 million a year out of that. That's service. That's using your head in order to attain a legislative objective where it is clear that the welfare objective per se, naturally, Mr. D'Amato would set that as a standard, because he ought to know that he doesn't, that that's one of the most immovable things in the Congress so far. So we've worked around it, and I've done that for years and years.
Now, we seem to be seeing some changes in our major parties in this country. I wonder how you feel about a Democrat, Ed Koch, seeking the Republican designation, whether you would support that, and whether you feel, if that does happen, that it indicates a change in what is happening to our parties and what they stand for.
Well, I've had experience with that. Generally, I have deprecated the effort by my party, one of the two great parties, leave out for the moment these minority parties, including the Liberal and the Right to Life and the Conservative. Generally, I have favored choosing our own candidate because it gives the party integrity and the function and the purpose and encourages new people in our party to seek high office and gives the party a sense of responsibility as to the affairs of cities and states. I rather think that municipal elections, which in many cases are nonpartisan, might conceivably, though I haven't felt that way in the past, be an exception to that idea, and I'm willing to inventory it. But I have not felt that way, I'm telling you quite honestly. In the past, I have felt that the two major parties, as they are the logical opposition to each other and the alternative that the people ought to have, should choose their own candidates. As always, something to debate, something to criticize, something to discuss. I admire Ed Koch. I knew him as a colleague in the Congress. I think he's done a very fine job for New York. There's little doubt about that. And yet I believe that when you get down to the record at the end of his term and he runs for re-election, there may be many things, which I don't know now, upon which there could be very considerable discussion and debate. And that's a healthy thing for the people. And I'm very reluctant to see my party forego it. But nonetheless, as I say, this may be the exception to the general rule. That is my
point. So you just to clarify, you have the option of endorsing Mr. Koch for the Republican designation, but you're not ready to say so at this point.
That's I'm ready to consider it seriously, which I might not have said some time ago, but I do say it about Ed Koch. But I do feel that as a matter of principle, it is not particularly advisable in a two-party system.
Sitting in your office here, and looking around at the memorabilia they have go back for many years, and many times. You've been through a lot of campaigns before.
Yes, I have.
Is this going to be old hat for you?
Oh, no. Every campaign is a new campaign, just like every election with the people is a new election. They're entitled to choose as if it were the first time. But as a matter of history, I have been through five statewide campaigns of my own, of course, many others with others, like Kevin Rock, and four campaigns for Congress.
So this is not at all a new experience for you. You think it really helps keep any office holder on his mettle?
Yes, I think it does. I really believe it presents new problems. You not only have to deal with your record, indeed I say, your record is only an augury as to what kind of a keeper of promises you may be. And that's why I'm so proud of my record, because I try to keep every promise I make. Also, I believe that it sharpens you. It gives you a sense of the issues. It submits you to intensive debate on the issues. And it gives you a touch with the people, which is both gratifying and very instructive. So I like the ideas which are involved, though I know you, I say myself, you get exhausted and lose 10 or a dozen pounds before you're through. It is a tough job, to campaign, especially when you have both a primary and a general election campaign, which I have this time.
Well, one of the issues that your opponent has brought up is his contention that you are not what you claim to be, that you campaign as a Republican, and yet you do not behave in office as if you were a Republican and don't espouse a Republican tendency.
Well, frankly, that's kind of empty right now, and I'll tell you why. I have been what I am for so many years, and I have been elected and re-elected on the Republican ticket for so many years. That's hardly valid as to me. The Republicans know who I am. I have no identity crisis. I've called them as I saw them, and what I consider to be the best interests of the people of this state and of our nation. And that's what I've been elected on, and I suddenly can't become something different. I am a Republican, and my opponent seeks to fuzz that up because I do believe very deeply in the individual initiative of the person and a complete equal opportunity, everybody on the same starting line, and the necessary equipment that goes with it, education and training and an ability to get a job. And I believe also deeply in the private enterprise system. The fact that 90% of our people work in the private enterprise system is the surest guarantee of our freedom. They're not beholden to any political power for a job. And this, I think, is what is republicanism, its essence. And I have that. In addition, if elected, I always vote to organize whatever branch of the legislature I'm in with my party, and when it comes to party line matters, and there are not too many of those, like when do you adjourn, or when do you sit, or what people do you put on committees, or certain special things like that, which are the decisive question politically, I always stay with my party. Nobody's ever complained about me in that. When it comes to issues, I believe that my duty is to represent all the people, whatever may be their political faith, whatever may be their ethnicity, their color, their creed. I represent them all, and I do my utmost to bespeak, therefore, what I consider their aggregate best interest.
Well, some of the specifics that have been brought up in the past, and you've already dealt with them, but I would like to have you reiterate, if possible, some of the things that took place during the Republican convention, the platform that was finally adopted. Not all of the things in there would seem to be something that you would voluntarily espouse. Does that make it difficult for you?
No, I don't involuntarily espouse them either. In other words, I've said it many times. I've been to
presidential conventions as a Republican office holder since 1948. That's a lot of conventions. And at all times, I've said that I'm with a candidate of a party. Generally, I have been, except in the Goldwater case in 1964.
When, because of his position
on the use of the atomic weapon, I just couldn't stay with him in that year, though I didn't, was not for anybody else. I just
stayed out of the campaign. It's very interesting that
the Goldwater is on commercial television for me now, urging that in the amalgam of the Senate, he wants to see me back there, which is very gratifying. An interesting commentary on his rugged honesty, which is no question about. But returning to the situation, I have never slavishly followed any Republican platform.
I can't. But I've tried, where I could, to accept
the view
of my party on a platform question. Bring that right down to the moment.
I could not accept the party opposition
to the ratification of the ERA, the amendment respecting the equality of women.
Nor could I accept the party's platform that called for a constitutional amendment
to make abortion illegal. I'm with a Supreme Court decision
on that, giving the woman the right
to make her own choice
based upon the advance of the pregnancy,
the trimester situation. And I couldn't go with a litmus paper test for judges to be sure that on abortion issues, they would rule with the anti-abortionists.
That's not what our judiciary
is all about. Or the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit opposition. On the other hand, when it came to the business aspects of the platform, that is,
how we deal with American
business, when it came to stimulating a modernization of American business through tax inducement, when it came to the Middle East plan of the platform, and a good many other things, I found myself in great agreement.
But I cannot swallow the whole.
And that's what my opponent proposes to do.
Your opponent claims that he is the one who is actually dealing with the issues. Do you find that to be the case?
I think it's exactly the reverse, because he has no record upon these issues of inflation, unemployment, question of peace in the world, question of
healthcare,
education, all on the federal level. He has no record. He's been a town supervisor, and incidentally, way in a town where the supervisor has no jurisdiction over police, fire, health, and many other things. It's a fairly limited capacity. But
be that as it may,
the fact is that he has no equipment for this. He comes completely unprepared to it. Now, he's a fellow who's got a quick
study
mind, but very superficial. And so I have had constantly to refute the fact that I voted for this or that when I didn't, or that I didn't and I did, because it's essentially a
one-sided
proposition.
Now, some of the allegations concern the voting for aid to Cuba, the voting for aid in Nicaragua, very broad.
I'd like to answer that because it's a very
significant point. It is very important to this country, and even in terms of business,
that the developing countries of the world, the poor,
manage to stay
afloat financially. And hence, we have depended heavily upon the multilateral banking institutions like the World Bank and the International
Monetary Fund to sustain them. Now, that's quite a problem because these poor countries are also paying through the nose for oil. And hence, they have built up surplus. They have built up deficits constantly in the last in the years since 73.
I don't know
where that will end and how we will ultimately resolve it. But in the meantime, it's a very dangerous situation for the money of the world and also for the trade of the world. For example, our country does 40% of its exports with these poor countries, developing countries. So to keep these banks in business,